Fear shall always be victorious, Jesse answered. Oh, yeah, Dave snorted. Always, huh? That name didn't work for those lizards. Screw them. Jesse had no sympathy for the Kristang, even if the crew of the Victorious had been vaporized in a sneak attack. The database says the Ruhar ship up there is a battleship, the Tos Blendaro. Dave laughed. I wonder if her crew calls her the Blender. Jesse laughed, too. I don't think Blender means the same thing in Ruhar. Tos Blendaro is the name of a Ruhar planet, according to the database. The three silently contemplated the giant alien battleship orbiting over their heads. Hey, Cornpo. Hey, Ski. What's up? I was just thinking. When I first heard Bish stole a dropship and went off on a crazy mission to hit the Kristang, I thought that was typical Bishop, you know? A stupid idea that had no chance of working. Like, what the hell could a group of humans in one dropship do against the Kristang, right? Then we flew around this planet in one little buzzard and blew the hell out of an entire freaking battle group. Now I'm thinking, what the hell? Maybe Joe actually did something useful up there. Maybe it wasn't just a signature Bishop grand gesture. Joe would do that? Shauna asked. Although she had spent private time with Joe Bishop, she was realizing she didn't really know him like his former fire teammates did. Oh, yes, yeah, Shauna, Dave assured her. Joe is all about the grand gesture. Especially if it's stupid, Jesse agreed. Really? Shauna considered that she hadn't ever known Joe at all. Not really. Like using an ice cream truck against a Ruhar assault team, Dave mentioned. Hey, for Bish, that was a smart idea, Jesse observed. Jumping on top of an anti-tank mine to save us in Nigeria, now that was a classic Bishop feudal grand gesture. Yeah. You know, though, Dave tilted his head in thought, if stealing that dropship and going after the Kristang really was a grand gesture, Joe wouldn't have brought volunteers along with him. He wouldn't have risked other people's lives. He must have thought the plan, whatever it was, had a real chance to succeed. Oh, come on, Ski, Jesse scoffed. You still think Bish was in command of that op? Yes. Why? He was a colonel. Bish was a colonel like I'm a colonel, Jesse shook his head. Promoting him was a publicity stunt. He knew that better than anybody. He was a figurehead. That's what he was on that op. No freaking way could Joe ever figure out how to steal a Ruhar dropship, and him plan an assault against Kristang ships? No way. Somebody else was in command. They used Joe as window dressing. You think that really was a UNEF Special Forces operation? Shauna asked. UNEF says they didn't know anything about it. Yeah, and that's what they would say if it went south. Jesse turned the telescope off. The Ruhar battleship was sliding below the horizon. Odds are the Ruhar were in command of that op. They needed humans as cover, or something like that. It's the only explanation that fits them using a dropship. No way in hell any humans could steal a dropship. Just to fly our stolen buzzard, Lieutenant Strebick needed Emby to grant her access. I can guarantee there were Ruhar involved in Joe's op somewhere along the line. That makes sense, Shauna agreed. She hadn't given the subject much thought. Anyway, Dave pulled up the collar of his jacket against the chill of the night. I guess it's possible that Bish did something good up there. Yeah, before he got himself killed, Jesse added quietly. Why do you say that? Shauna asked. Jesse took one last look at the sky, a sky filled with hostile aliens. He's not here, is he? Where else could he go? A dropship can't fly all the way back to Earth. Two members of Major Perkins's team were entirely happy to hear about their new assignment. More than happy, they were thrilled. Pilots Irene Strebick and Derek Bonsu were thrilled to hear they would continue to fly. And not only fly, this time they got to fly a special modified long-range version of the Buzzard transport. The hull was stretched, which meant they could fit the drill rig, plenty of spare parts, and the team would not be squashed between the drill rig and the cockpit. This buzzard even had seats that lay completely flat for sleeping, and a fully equipped tiny galley. Compared to their Arctic mission, this would be a luxury vacation. Because the projector they were to reactivate was on an island far offshore, almost a quarter of the way around the planet, Even the buzzard's additional power cells would not provide enough range to get there and back. So Irene and Derek had to not only be certified to fly the different type of buzzard, they had to learn and become proficient at mid-air refueling. When the projector was fully operational and the buzzards were on their return to base, a dropship would be descending from orbit to refuel them. Irene did not have any doubts she could master flying the new type of aircraft. A buzzard was a sweet bird to handle, and a couple extra tons of mass weren't going to change its basic flight characteristics. Buzzard engines were overpowered. Irene knew the engines of her new ship would not have any problem carrying the drill rig, full crew, and all their supplies. Nor was she worried about refueling in mid-air. She had done simulations of Ruhar procedures for aerial refueling, and the process was almost fully automated. The actual procedures she had witnessed were so simple a baby could do it. The baby aircraft approached the mother ship, and the mother ship took control of the baby's navigation, linking the two aircraft as one. The power connection then extended from the mother ship, guiding itself into the port on the aircraft to be refueled. Once connected, it took less than a minute to bring the baby's power cells up to full charge, then the connection retracted itself, and navigation control was restored. The Ruhar in-flight refueling procedure was child's play compared to refueling operations Irene had done as a Black Hawk pilot. One time in a driving rainstorm over the Nigerian jungle at night, she had been nursing a stricken Black Hawk that was leaking fuel from shot-up tanks. The rate of fuel draining from the tanks was even greater than the rate of fuel being rapidly gulped by the one thirsty turboshaft engine that was still operational. Irene had her one working engine screaming at full power as the Hilo lurched in a raging thunderstorm. Being over dense jungle under insurgent control, with no place to land and 8 wounded soldiers, she would have run the tanks dry and crashed, except for a blessed angel appearing in the ungainly, fat form of a C-130 Hercules. It took her 4 tries, with the bullet-crazed cockpit windows lit up by the blinding strobe effect of lightning arcing through the clouds, to connect to the refueling drogue. The tanks were too leaky to top off, so she took on as much fuel as she could. Then she was forced to disconnect from the refueling drogue as the wind shear grew too dangerous for the C-130. The Herc climbed to get above the dangerously roiling winds of the thunderstorm, but Irene had to fly through it, her own bird bouncing up and down hundreds of feet in the brutal winds. It was a race to see which would happen first, the thunderstorm blowing itself out, or the fuel tanks running dry and the turboshaft sputtering and dying. Or, Irene had thought to herself, another possible source of impending doom was the rotor blades over her head losing lift as the Black Hawk was slammed toward the treetops by violent downdrafts. She had survived that night, as did 7 of the 8 wounded soldiers she was carrying. The storm lessened enough for the C-130 to return, and she had been able to hook up for another half tank of fuel. When she landed on a dirt road miles from base, she had been soaked to the skin, and she had not been sure how much was from sweat, how much was from rain splattering through bullet holes in the windows, or whether she had peed her pants in terror. If it were the latter, she wouldn't be ashamed. She had gone through 40 minutes of thinking every moment would be her last, and her greatest fear had been getting her crew and the wounded soldiers killed. That incident is what she thought of when she was taking simulator training for in-flight refueling of a buzzard. "This shit is easy," she told herself without bravado. She would like to see a hotshot Ruhar pilot refuel a Black Hawk at night, even in good weather. Refueling a Black Hawk behind a C-130 Hercules, with the drogue being buffeted by the 4 spinning turboprops of the Herky Bird and the Black Hawk's own whirling rotors. The Ruhar, she was certain, would pee their pants every time if they had to perform such a task in a primitive human aircraft. The simulator gave her a passing rating, and Derek Bonsu also passed easily. The two humans didn't even have a silent, unspoken rivalry about their rating in the sim. The Ruhar refueling process was so laughably easy there was no point to a contest between them. The next step was an actual refueling test, aboard the actual buzzard they would be flying on the mission. Irene and Derek gave their new ship a thorough inspection and found everything well-worn, and the maintenance logs indicated a long list of recent repairs. After their first checkout flight, Irene and Derek added a dozen squawks in the log, noting problems they had found. The Ruhar crew chief was not happy to see more work added to his schedule.
"You report the rear ramp would not fully extend in flight until you cycled it twice,
and then it would not seal properly after it was retracted? Why would you, he emphasized the last word scornfully, ever need to open the ramp in flight?
We would need to open the ramp in flight, Irene explained with a patience she did not feel, if the ship is in trouble and we need to dump the drill rig to lighten our load, for example, over open water.
She mentally added an unspoken, you jackass. Their Ruhar flight instructor, who was not the most friendly person Irene had ever met, cut off the crew chief's scathing reply.
The human is correct. It must be fixed. The first eight items on the list must be fixed before we fly again. The other items are simple and should not take significant time to remedy.
I will add this ship to the schedule. The crew chief glared at the flight instructor, feeling betrayed by his fellow Ruhar. My crew is overworked. He swept a hand across the parked rows of aircraft and dropships needing maintenance before they could fly. Many of the aircraft still had battle damage that had only been catalogued, not even scheduled for repair. The battle group had brought in a wave of replacement aircraft, and most of them had a lengthy list of issues to be fixed before they could be considered flightworthy. As usual, Gitanu got the unwanted leftovers from other Ruhar worlds.
We have combat aircraft that require priority attention. This ship, he rapped his knuckles on the composite fuselage, will not be in the air again for 10 days, if not longer.
No,
Nert declared quietly, and the crew chief raised an eyebrow. Until Nert spoke, the crew chief had not even acknowledged the young cadet's presence.
We have in-flight refueling practice maneuvers scheduled for tomorrow. After tomorrow, the refueling dropship will not be available for another 3 days. The humans are needed for a mission of vital importance to the security of Gitanu. This aircraft must be returned to flightworthy status by tomorrow morning.
Cadet, who are you to... The crew chief began hotly.
His aunt is Baterna Logelia, the flight instructor explained. And this little shit, he pointed to Nert, we'll not hesitate to call her. I suggest you get your crews to work overnight if necessary. I want to check out flight 1 hour after sunrise, and there had better not be any additional problems, unless you want to find yourself fixing toilets.
Nert grinned and winked at Irene and Derek. Irene gave him a half-smile back. She didn't like pulling rank, especially when it involved politics, and particularly she did not like people using family connections to get favors. In this case, with the Ruhar openly biased against humans, she could not fault Nert for doing his job as their team's liaison. The deputy administrator wanted Major Perkins's team to begin their mission in 3 days. That meant Irene and Derek had to perform their in-flight refueling test the next day. Any slip in the schedule would be an excuse for the Ruhar to remove humans from the projector mission. The Buzzard was fully ready for flight the next morning. Irene knew that because the crew chief had helpfully sent updates to her Z-phone every half hour while she was trying to sleep. After the third update, when she had been unable to silence her Z-phone, she had tucked it under the mattress and drifted off to a restful sleep. The crew chief had not been as resentful as she expected. Partly she thought the Ruhar was proud that his crews had addressed all the squawks so quickly. The check ride, with the flight instructor at the controls and Irene in the co-pilot seat, went acceptably, so they contacted the refueling dropship. During the first actual refueling maneuver, behind a real dropship, Irene had been singing quietly to herself, even yawning with boredom. The Ruhar flight trainer made her and Derek each go through basic refueling process 3 times. Then he screwed with them. The instructor deactivated the flight computer, forcing Irene to fly manually. That was no problem for her. Flying the Big Buzzard on manual was easier than flying a Black Hawk. The instructor threw more problems at her. Power failures, intermittent system glitches, complete loss of sensors at night. For that last scenario, Irene had calmly donned vision-enhancing goggles and flew smoothly to connect to the refueling cable on her first attempt. Finally, the instructor told Irene that the Buzzard had lost power to one engine, the second engine was on fire, and the power cells had less than 1% remaining. Irene pulled the Buzzard into a gentle turn away from the lumbering dropship, reduced the blazing engine to idle, and activated the fire suppression system.
"What are you doing?" the flight instructor pointed anxiously at the dropship. "Your fuel state is critical. You must connect immediately or we will lose power permanently."
Yes, Irene responded without looking at him. With fire in one engine, procedure prohibits approaching the tanker ship due to risk of explosion. If I am able to put out the fire, and the engine throttles up successfully, I can try to connect. She looked directly at him, since the instructor decided how the scenario would play out.
Correct. The instructor avoided her eyes. Strabek, I judge you have performed adequately. Derek Bonsu, take the pilot seat, it is your turn.
As Irene strapped into the jump seat next to Nert, she allowed herself a ghost of a smile.
Performed adequately? She asked herself. Sure, she thought, like the sun might rise the next morning.
She had aced the test, and she knew Derek would do the same. Whether the internal politics of the Ruhar on Paradise would cancel the mission was something she had no control over. The flight instructor refused to state whether he would mark Irene and Derek as ready to make a long overwater flight in a new model of Buzzard. Major Perkins met her two pilots in the ready room her team had been assigned at the airbase.
Well? Lieutenant, did the instructor approve the two of you for flight?
I don't know, ma'am, Irene admitted. We did everything by the book. I think the instructor was pissed that we didn't break something. That asshole better not give me a taco on that exercise. We were freaking perfect.
Taco?
Nert asked, confused by the translation.
An unsatisfactory rating begins with the letter U, Derek explained while sketching a U-shape in the air with a finger. A taco shell looks kinda like a U.
You passed. You will be approved,
Nert interjected. You spoke with the instructor? Perkins asked.
Yes, but I didn't need to. The pilots did everything correctly. He can't justify failing them based on performance. Although I do think he wanted to. Major Perkins, my aunt wishes your team to fly this mission. Unless the pilots made a terrible error, they were guaranteed to pass.
Great. Thank you, Derek said sarcastically. That makes me feel wonderful about it.
Oh, no,
Nert rushed to add.
You both achieved more than a 95% score overall. I do not know the exact rating for either of you. All I can tell is you were rated.
The translator stumbled over the word. Nert frowned and looked up something on his e-phone. Then he spoke without the translator.
Your word is outstanding, I think is the correct translation.
He switched the translator back on.
The flight instructor told me he believes your success is due to the fact that you have been trained to fly your own primitive human aircraft, which is more difficult than flying a Ruhar aircraft. That makes up for your slow reflexes and general lack of coordination and fine muscle skills.
Thank you, Nert, Irene said while rolling her eyes at Derek. We appreciate the compliment.
It is my pleasure, Lieutenant Strebik.
Nert cluelessly beamed with pride. Perkins rolled her eyes at that remark.
We have an aircraft, then. Jarrett reported the drill rig had been serviced and is ready and waiting for us. We need to get it checked out top to bottom, then loaded aboard the Buzzard today.
Ma'am?
Irene looked stricken.
Bonsu and I got up at 03:30, and it's been a stressful day. We were hoping to catch some rest.
I understand that, Major Perkins said with sympathy. Lieutenant, we need to make damn sure some Ruhar doesn't think it is his patriotic duty to remove us from this mission by sabotaging the drill rig or our ability to carry it safely in the Buzzard.
Irene opened her mouth and quickly closed it. She had considered the possibility of sabotage or sloppy workmanship affecting her Buzzard, but she had given no thought to the drill rig itself.
Yes, ma'am.
Jared is in Hangar 4 with Chaika and Coulter. Go take charge over there. Perkins ordered.
You're not coming with us, Major?
Derek asked, surprised. Perkins was typically a hands-on leader.
I'll join you when I can. Right now, our liaison and I are going over to the admin building to assure there isn't some unfortunate paperwork glitch in you and Strebik getting signed off for flight duty.
Nert, listening to the translation in his Z-phone earpiece, was puzzled.
Unlike humans, we do not use paper, Major Perkins. Our records are stored in...
I understand that, Cadet Danderf. My meaning is that I intend to assure there are no unintended or intentional delays in getting their flight status officially logged into whatever system stores that data.
Ah,
Nert nodded.
I understand. That would be wise.
He knew many of his fellow Ruhar were not happy that humans were being given another opportunity, especially as the humans were taking the place of Ruhar who would love to be on a projector reactivation team.
And I believe that I know the person we must speak with.
Great, Cadet. Lead the way. Irene and Derek assumed Shauna Jarrett, who somehow along the way had become their drill rig expert, would merely check the rig's records, maybe look at the inspection tags, and roll it across the airfield to the waiting buzzard. But no. Major Perkins had ordered Shauna to assure the drill rig was in perfect working order, and that is exactly what Shauna intended to do.
Seriously? Irene asked, eyes wide. You want to drill into the airbase?
Irene, Lieutenant Strebik. She remembered that her friend Irene was also an officer.
We won't know for certain this thing works unless we see it in action. Nert got us permission to drill into that stretch of grass over behind Hangar 5. There aren't any buried pipes or cables in that area.
Oh, Derek groaned. This is going to take all day.
No, sir, Jesse grinned. We should be done in time for dinner.
Yeah, Dave agreed.
Then we just need to get it over to the buzzard, stowed away and secured.
Oh, and all the spare parts have to get loaded and tied down.
Shouldn't take longer than... What do you think, Cornpone, midnight?
Jesse whistled.
That may be ambitious, but we can try.
Welcome to the Army, sir. He winked at Lieutenant Bonsu.
The pitifully few ships of Admiral Cacrondo's once mighty, conquering battle group hung motionless in deep space, far from the star which bathed the planet Perdassus with warm, life-giving light. That far out, the ships could only be seen by their blinking navigation lights. The star was a mere dot, and Perdassus could not be seen by the naked eye. No, he could not call the planet Perdassus, Cacrondo told himself. With the Ruhar having stationed a battle group there, and in the process of constructing a strategic defense satellite network around the planet, it would never again be called Perdassus by anyone who lived there. Gitanu. The planet would now forever be known as Gitanu.
All ships in formation, Admiral, said a voice behind Admiral Cacrondo.
The voice was quiet and hesitant, as it should be under such shameful circumstances. Shame did not belong directly to the speaker, being only the second in command of the destroyer. But the stench of Cacrondo's overwhelming failure infected everyone around that unfortunate senior warrior.
Very well,
Cacrondo acknowledged in a clear, strong voice. A voice accustomed to command. A voice unaccustomed to failure or shame. Until now.
Initiate compliance with Jarraptha docking requirements. All reactors in cold shutdown except for the auxiliary power units aboard each ship. Stealth and sensors fields deactivated. Defensive energy shields on standby.
The Jarraptha would not allow the powerful defense shields of the Kristang ships to be active for the docking procedure, but they understood ships would need to protect themselves from being impacted by random space junk, even at the far outskirts of the star system.
All weapons safed, he ordered,
knowing even the defensive maser turrets were included in that category. Anything that might pose a threat to a massive Jarraptha star carrier had to be completely deactivated. The Jarraptha insisted maser cannons needed to have their exciters decoupled from their power supplies. All missiles must have detonators removed from warheads.
And Kartow,
Cacrondo turned to stare at the destroyer's executive officer.
No cheating. Clan leadership had ordered me to deliver these ships back home in one piece. If the Jarraptha discover we are cheating, and if even one ship is cheating, they will discover it. Then consequences will be dire for all of us. Signal all ships.
All ships that remain, he thought bitterly.
I do not want anyone trying to be a hero or to claim glory for themselves. Is that understood?
Kartow saluted.
Understood, Admiral, he said,
then almost scurried away to pass along the Admiral's commands. In truth, Kartow, like everyone else in the depleted battle group, wished to be as far away as possible from their disgraced admiral. Proximity carried the potential of Cacrondo's shame spreading to others. For certainly, with a failure of such epic proportions, there was more than enough disgrace and shame for more than one person. Cacrondo stood with uncharacteristic silence as the crew busied themselves around him,
no one daring even glance at the Admiral, for fear his shame and eventual fate were contagious. Cicrondo listened as his orders were passed along to the other ships. No cheating, he heard. Left to himself, he would have liked to cheat, to do more than just cheat. He would have liked to wait for the Jarapha star carriers to emerge from jump and approach, then Cicrondo would have opened up on them with every weapon his ships had. The result would have been the certain destruction of all his remaining ships, but possibly he could have severely damaged, even destroyed, one or both star carriers. Striking such a blow against the patrons of the Ruhar would have been an immensely satisfying, if futile, and even counterproductive gesture. But it was not to be. Clan leadership had ordered Cicrondo to bring his remaining ships safely home, where they would be needed for a Krestang civil war that was now all but inevitable. Loss of the combat power of one battle group was bad enough. Worse still was the enormous loss of prestige for the clan. Such shame made it difficult for the clan to keep existing allies and attract new clans to an alliance, even a temporary arrangement. Cicrondo's failure had made the entire clan appear weak. He could not blame other clans for their scorn. His had been a monumental failure, a disaster that would be studied for generations as an example of what not to do when in command of an isolated battle group. Cicrondo knew the clan leaders had ordered his subordinate officers to relieve the Admiral of command if he attempted to strike the Jarapha. Such relief would come in the form of a pistol round to the Admiral's skull. Cicrondo had appeared in the skies over Perdassus with overwhelming combat power, instantly establishing supremacy in space around the planet. Nothing, then, could move within 12 light minutes of Perdassus without Cicrondo knowing and approving, and everything and everyone on the surface existed because he had wished them to continue existing. He could have been forgiven for the loss of the majority of his ships. No one could have foreseen the Ruhar's use of unknown maser cannons. Even clan leadership, who of course would not be accepting any blame for themselves, would be reluctant to punish Cicrondo for falling victim to a shocking, vicious, dishonorable sneak attack. What the clan leadership could not abide was what happened next. Even following the projector attack on Cicrondo's battlegroup, he had sufficient combat strength to prevent Commodore Ferlant's Ruhar task force from effectively protecting the planet. And then Senior Captain Gurkaw's pursuit squadron, which needed merely to keep Ferlant's ships busy and away from the planet, had been foolishly lured into a trap by the wily Ruhar commander. The fact that the idiot Gurkaw had exceeded his orders made no difference to clan leadership. The failure ultimately belonged to the commanding officer on the scene, Admiral Cicrondo. Even Cicrondo had to admit a greater disaster, a greater failure, could hardly be imagined. Clan leadership had sent him to Perdassus to secure the planet and its buried elder treasures for the clan. The riches of elder artifacts could vault the clan to the upper ranks of Krestang society. Instead, the planet was now firmly in the control of the hated Ruhar, who had discovered a priceless, fully functional elder power tap and a pair of working comm nodes. The fact that the incompetent Ruhar had screwed with and destroyed the elder devices made no difference to clan leadership. Those items beyond value should have been the property of the clan, and Cicrondo's own stunning, monumental incompetence had given them away to the Ruhar. Cicrondo knew he likely faced death when he returned. Lesser commanders might have taken the easy way out by using a pistol, a knife, or even poison. Such cowardice was not for a proud warrior. Cicrondo would face the clan leaders with his head held high and offer whatever analysis and advice as he could before meeting his fate. By retaining his dignity as a warrior, Cicrondo hoped to save his ship captains from sharing his own fate. "All ships acknowledge your orders, Admiral," Kartow announced from his duty station, not wishing to come any closer to the symbol of disgrace. "The Ruhar transport ships are in position. Their defensive systems are active." Cicrondo answered only with a curt nod of his head. The presence of two Ruhar transport ships deeply puzzled him. Aboard those two ships were over 6,700 humans, who referred to themselves as Keepers of the Faith. The Admiral could understand why the Ruhar had agreed to transport the troublesome Keepers away from their planet. Sending those pesky humans away would reduce the security burden on the Ruhar. He could not yet understand why clan leadership had agreed to accept the humans. Cicrondo could not see how such primitive, untrustworthy creatures could possibly be useful to the clan.
Human soldiers, even the best of them, hardly offered enough of a challenge to make hunting them enjoyable sport. Perhaps the clan leadership intended the humans to be used for training young Kristang warriors to hunt with knives and bare hands. Or perhaps clan leadership planned to sell humans to other clans as curiosities or for sport. No matter. That was not Kakrondo's concern. No, what puzzled him most was why the Keepers had volunteered to leave Perdassus with the Kristang. If they thought their continued display of loyalty impressed their patrons, they were greatly, fatally mistaken. Seeing humans divided between loyalty to the Ruhar and Kristang only reinforced the Kristang's firmly held opinion that humans were weak. Kakrondo could only imagine that the Keepers were the type of rigid-thinking creatures who could not accept reality when their beliefs were challenged, could not adapt as all living things must. Adapt, if they wished to continue living. One thing Admiral Kakrondo was certain of was that the almost 7,000 Keepers would not continue living very long. Chapter 7 39 Commandos Jaquar altered course to fly into a rain squall. Such brief, intense rainstorms were common over the tropical ocean, but the Jaquar crew had found squalls frustratingly sparse that day. The heat sinks in the belly of the dropship had been approaching critical temperature and needed to be ejected soon, or the all-important stealth would be compromised. As the dropship flew into the storm, the pilots allowed it to be buffeted by the gusty winds, for using power to stabilize the Jaquar's flight path might be detected. Once the dropship was fully within the squall cloud, its skin pelted by fat raindrops, the co-pilot activated controls to eject the heat sinks. A door briefly opened on the belly of the dropship, and two objects dropped out. After falling a few meters, parachutes opened to slow their descent, because a speedy fall of such heavy objects might be detected. Each heat sink was surrounded by a thermal insulation shell, trapping the heat inside. Within the shell, the heat sinks were far beyond their melting point, and the shells would not survive long. They did not have to. Within a few minutes, the heat sinks hit the ocean surface with a gentle splash, the parachutes retracted, and the heat sinks began falling toward the bottom of the sea. The two shells failed around the same time, within seconds of each other. Cracks appeared, and when the contents of the shells leaked out, the ocean water flashed into steam. By then, the heat sinks were safely deep enough that the event was not noticed by the Ruhar sensor network. Above the waves, the Jaquar flew smoothly out of the rain squall into clear air. If any Ruhar had been close by, they would have wondered why water was falling from a clear patch of sky as water dripped off the Jaquar's surface. Satisfied the heat sink ejection was not detected, the pilots turned back to their original course and increased speed slightly. Excess heat was now being dumped into two new heat sinks, and the pilots watched the instruments carefully. The Jaquar had only a limited number of heat sinks, which could not be reused. Luck would have to be with them on this mission. Ruhar personnel at the airbase watched with curiosity, or disdain, or a mixture of both, as the odd human creatures drove the drill rig behind a hangar. The humans not only practiced setting up and taking down the drill, they actually fitted a bit to the drill and began chewing down into the soil. Every Ruhar on the base knew this group of humans had a mission to reactivate one of the last projectors. The humans might be crude, they might be paranoid, but no one could say they were not taking their mission very seriously. The humans were absolutely thorough about making certain the rig was ready for the mission. Even the Ruhar who hated humans as occupier lackeys of the Kristang had to admit this particular team of humans was admirably professional. The drill was operating normally for the first 20 feet. Then Shauna began tapping the display on her Z-phone with concern.
"Cut! Jesse! Cut the power! Now!"
Shauna shouted frantically, waving her arms. Jesse complied.
"Okay, done. What's the problem?"
All the instruments on the console in front of him were showing green. Not green, exactly, because the Ruhar used the color blue instead of green to indicate things were working properly. Both humans and Ruhar used red to indicate a problem, and there was no red on the console in front of Jesse.
"Everything shows normal here." "Normal how? It wouldn't be normal if we'd kept going," Shauna insisted. "Look at the temperature of the upper coupling."
Jesse checked it, looked at Dave for confirmation,
and Dave nodded. It's running a little hot, Jesse admitted. Still within normal limits. Run the instrument data back. Shauna walked over to the console and ran the instrument data backward, then let it display forward. See? She stabbed a fingertip on the display. It starts perfectly normal. Then here, right here, it spikes. And keeps going. Dave's eyes grew wide.
Sorry, Shauna. I was only looking for trouble. My attention was on the drill
head. Jesse hung his head. Shauna was right. The coupling temperature had spiked, and he hadn't noticed it on the console. Shauna had been monitoring the drill rig sensors through her Z-phone, and she had seen it. Even now, with the rig's power cut off, the coupling temperature was still increasing.
Hey, this is screwy, he noticed. The temperature gauge of the coupling shows it's fine. We're getting a high temperature reading from the housing itself. I don't get it.
Me neither, Shauna replied, her jaw set.
This drill rig is supposed to have been completely refurbished for us. The chief mechanic signed off that it was ready.
Irene exhaled in exasperation.
Jarrett, it's a good thing you insisted on an operational test.
She hated to admit it, but making the drill rig crawl behind the hangar and setting it up to drill into the ground had been well worth the time and effort. They had drilled barely 30 feet down before Shauna had detected the problem.
Lieutenant Strebick, I'd like to look inside, Shauna said hopefully.
I don't know, Jarrett, Irene said uncertainly.
A group of Ruhar had been watching the drill rig from the back door of a hangar. Now one of them was headed in their direction.
We're not supposed to screw with Ruhar equipment.
It was the freaking Ruhar who told us this thing was in perfect condition, Shauna pointed out. We can't trust them.
She's right about that, Derek agreed.
Oh, hell, Irene muttered. How much more trouble could we get into? Jarrett, pop this thing open.
Shauna moved quickly. She had Jesse and Dave lower the rig horizontally so she could access the upper coupling. Even before it had completed lowering itself, she hopped onto the grating and turned two levers to open an inspection hatch. Seeing that, the Ruhar coming from the hangar broke into a run.
Damn it,
Shauna shouted, her left arm inside the rig up to her shoulder. She pushed hoses out of the way until she had a good view of the lubricant reservoir. Just as the Ruhar stomped across the grass, angrily waving his arms and shouting at Shauna, a car roared up to the drill rig, and Major Perkins and Nert got out.
What is the problem here?
I am a mechanic,
the angry Ruhar explained through a Z-phone translator.
Your people have interfered with...
We had to shut down the rig around 30 feet, Major, Irene reported. Jarrett noticed a problem. A coupling was overheating.
This is bullshit. Total bullshit, Shauna spat angrily.
What is the problem? Major Perkins repeated, peering over Shauna's shoulder.
This.
Shauna tapped a clear bottle that was barely visible behind a complicated array of pipes and hoses.
I noticed the upper coupling gearbox was running hot, but the instrument said there was plenty of this lubricating fluid being sprayed onto this coupling here. See this?
Perkins couldn't actually see much with Shauna's arm in the way.
And, ma'am, this fluid reservoir is empty, even though the instruments say it's full. That's what clued me in to look. The fluid level should have dropped a little while the drill was operating.
Can you remove the reservoir? Perkins asked.
I can do it. But this gentleman here, she pointed at the enraged Ruhar, says we humans are not authorized to perform maintenance on this machinery. I wasn't even supposed to open this inspection hatch, even though,
she glared back at the Ruhar,
it is a hatch that is designed to open so you can inspect the inside of the rig.
Perkins nudged Shauna aside gently so she could get a better view inside the hatch.
Remove it.
It was an awkward move, but the reservoir was designed to be easily replaced, so Shauna's nimble fingers were able to get the restraining clips undone. Then she rotated it 90 degrees until it came loose.
Son of a bitch, she spat as she pulled it out of the hatch.
Look, the fluid level indicator here is jammed. Stuck. That's why it read full when it was empty.
Oh, shit.
She handed the clear bottle to Perkins.
Someone messed with it, Major. The indicator has glue or something holding it to the full position.
Perkins examined the reservoir closely, then held it out for the others to see.
Yes, I see it. It looks like glue. It could be some residue, if the fluid dried out and congealed.
No way, ma'am, Dave said, shaking his head.
That little dot of glue is dark blue. The lubricant fluid is pink.
Shauna's right, ma'am. This is total bullshit.
Perkins shook the reservoir suspiciously. A few drops of light pink fluid ran down the inside of the bottle.
This is odd. Sabotaging the reservoir would not have prevented us from participating in this mission, she observed. We wouldn't have known about it until...
Oh, shit.
Yes, Shauna stated. It's worse. We would have flown all the way out there and busted the drill. This coupling is one component we don't carry a spare for. It's integrated with the housing and the motor. If the coupling burned out, it would be faster and easier for the Ruhar to fly out a new drill.
A new drill, with the Ruhar crew to operate it, Perkins glared at the Ruhar mechanic.
Because the stupid humans burned out their own drill.
I get it. As sabotage goes, this was reasonably smart. She turned to Nert. Cadet, can you inquire whether there are spare reservoirs like this on the base?
Oh!
Nert fairly bounced on his toes with eagerness to show his knowledge.
Yes, yes, there are spares. This is a common component used in our trucks and aircraft.
Excellent. Please arrange to have 3 reservoirs delivered, and my team will install one of them.
No, the mechanic protested. I will replace...
Perkins's wrath focused on the mechanic. Although he was more than a head taller than her, she stepped forward until they were toe to toe and she was glaring up into his brown eyes.
I am Major Emily Perkins. What is your name?
Sloan Janice. I am a master mechanic, he replied stiffly.
Mr. Janice, this is my team. I am responsible for the success of this mission. My team will replace the reservoir. I take full responsibility for any damage to the drill rig.
It is not necessary.
This could be sloppy workmanship, or it could be incompetent workers, or it could be sabotage.
She paused for the translation to catch up.
Either way, this is a very serious matter. This incident can either be reported up to the highest level.
She looked meaningfully at Nert, knowing the mechanic likely knew who the cadet was related to.
Or, we can assume this is a simple mechanical failure and take care of it ourselves right here, right now.
In one way, Ruhar culture was like human culture. Neither species liked higher authorities to be notified about problems if it could be avoided. The mechanic spoke slowly so the translator could keep up, and he could see Perkins's reaction to his words.
There is no need to involve anyone other than myself.
I would appreciate it if a master mechanic, such as yourself, would show my team how to properly install the replacement reservoir.
She stepped back from Janice, smiled, and softened her tone.
If there is a problem with another reservoir during our mission, we will need to replace it in the field by ourselves.
That made sense to Janice.
Major Emily, Major Perkins,
Nert interjected helpfully.
Major Perkins,
Janice tried again.
I will instruct your team in the proper procedure for replacing the fluid reservoir. And,
he glanced at Nert,
I will investigate how a malfunctioning component was installed by my team.
Janice appeared genuinely embarrassed and angry. Impulsively, he stuck out a hand, and Perkins shook it briefly. Briefly because she was sure the Ruhar did not enjoy touching a human. Master Mechanic Sloan Janice kept his word. He showed Shauna how to replace the reservoir and supervised as she instructed Jesse and Dave how to do it. Then, with the mechanic assisting, and a half-dozen idle and curious Ruhar watching. They set the drill rig upright again and put it back in action, drilling down to 100 feet in the relatively soft soil.
Jarrett, Perkins asked their de facto drill rig expert 3 hours later.
Are you satisfied with the performance of this rig?
Yes, ma'am, Shauna replied wearily.
She was hungry, and it was growing dark.
Excellent. Lieutenant Bonsu, get us something quick to eat. The rest of us are going to take this rig down and store it aboard the Buzzard.
It was 02:35 local time, the way humans reckoned time, when an exhausted Irene hit the button to close the Buzzard's back ramp.
Done. Oh, I am so tired, Irene said, resting her head against a structural rib inside the Buzzard's cargo compartment.
Does anyone want to get something to eat? Perkins added, silently hoping everyone would decline her offer.
I'm too tired to eat anything, ma'am, Derek responded.
Anyone else?
No.
Strebik, Bonsu, you two get some rack time. The rest of us are going to take shifts here. I'll go first.
Ma'am?
Jesse expressed surprise.
Major Perkins wrapped her knuckles on the buzzard's skin.
We got this buzzard and drill rig working perfectly. We are not going to risk anyone screwing with them. Until we take off in... She looked at her Z-phone to check her tired mind. One day and a wake-up. We are not letting anyone near this ship except for this team.
Nert spoke hesitantly.
Does that include me, Major Perkins?
There was a split-second hesitation in Perkins's reply while her mind raced through the potential risks. The local Ruhar had actively been working against her team, actively trying to exclude humans from missions of any importance.
Yes, Nert, it does include you. You will take the second shift. Report back here at 0330. That's human time.
Yes, I will,
Nert exclaimed excitedly as if he were at a fun summer camp.
Great. Perkins had to smile at the Ruhar cadet's enthusiasm.
I will send a duty rotation to everyone. We'll all take one-hour shifts. Except you, Strebik and Bonsu, you won't need to be back here until 1400.
I don't need that long, ma'am, Irene said as she attempted to stifle a yawn.
Yes, you do, Perkins insisted. We need the two of you to fly us the day after tomorrow. The rest of us can sleep while you are flying.
Yes, Major, Irene said gratefully.
I can't promise an in-flight movie.
I'll settle for peanuts.
Perkins was also fighting a yawn.
Peanuts are in short supply on this planet.
Understood. Now get out of here.
Nert arrived 15 minutes early for his shift as guard.
Good morning, Major Perkins, he said cheerily,
not looking at all as if he had just awakened from a 20-minute nap. Ruhar, with their genetically enhanced biology, did not need as much sleep as humans did, and a short, deep nap was refreshing enough for one day. Nert would need a solid night of sleep later.
Good morning, Cadet Danderf. You're here early?
Perkins blinked slowly to get her tired eyes to focus properly.
I am told that your military has a saying, if you are not early, you are late. It is similar in the Ruhar military.
That is good to know, thank you.
Do you have anything to report?
Nert asked, peering across the airbase.
Pools of light from poles here and there and hangars illuminated those areas, leaving twilight in between.
He swept an arc around the parked buzzard with vision-enhancing lenses, finding only two base personnel walking toward a line of Dobras.
Hmm?
Perkins forgot for a moment that she had been on guard duty.
No. People came over to speak with me twice. I did not allow them near the aircraft.
I shall do the same. Politely, of course.
Of course.
Nert glanced at his e-phone to check the time. It was 0322. His shift did not officially begin for another 8 minutes. The human female appeared tired, although he was not an expert on human facial expressions and body language.
Major Perkins, you may be relieved.
He hoped he had used the correct terminology. Z-phones often could not be trusted with subtle cultural nuances.
I am sufficiently rested.
Thank you, Nert. I will remain until 0330.
Perkins did not want to appear slack in front of a Ruhar.
Good!
Nert was delighted.
Major Perkins,
he looked away, avoiding eye contact.
During the flight, I would very much like to be aboard this aircraft.
Oh?
That surprised Perkins. All the other Ruhar would be aboard the lead buzzard. During their joint missions to reactivate projectors, they had never had a Ruhar with them. No Ruhar wanted to ride with lowly, primitive humans.
We would be pleased to have you with us, Perkins said, instantly questioning whether she should have said honored rather than pleased.
Nert made a short bow, grinning ear to ear.
Thank you, Major Perkins. As your team liaison, I believe it is proper that I remain with you.
You will need to bring your own food supply as well as any other, items you may require.
She stumbled awkwardly. She did not know about Ruhar sanitary habits,
and even this stretched version of the buzzard had only one cramped bathroom. The Ruhar bunks were considered comfortably large for humans, while Nert likely would not be able to fully stretch his legs out while he slept.
I will. This will be an adventure. I have never flown so far in a buzzard.
He used the unfamiliar human name for the aircraft, even knowing the name was vaguely insulting.
Great, Perkins thought to herself. We not only have a mission where our every move will be scrutinized and criticized, and now we not only will have an alien aboard for a very long flight, we will have a young and annoyingly enthusiastic alien aboard. Was there any way this mission could possibly become even more wonderful?
Admiral Cacrondo stood stiffly in his most formal uniform, waiting by the airlock door to the destroyer's portside docking bay. On a display mounted on the opposite wall, he could see the bay's large outer doors were open, and a sleek, dark green Giraptha dropship was maneuvering itself into position in the docking cradle. Cacrondo and a smattering of the ship's senior officers were there to greet the Giraptha inspection team, who would be assuring all ships under Cacrondo's nominal command were in compliance with their requirements for attaching to a massive yet vulnerable star carrier. Giraptha star carriers had transported Kristang ships before, just as the Theranin had transported Ruhar ships between the stars, but it was still an unusual and anxiety-inducing event for both sides. The enemy dropship attached itself firmly to the cradle, and the outer door began to slide ponderously closed. Once the outer doors were securely sealed, air would be pumped into the bay, and the Giraptha would emerge. 4 minutes remaining at least before the patrons of the Ruhar would step through the airlock and formally onto the deck of the destroyer. Cacrondo fervently prayed for death to somehow strike him before that moment. Beside the Admiral, Executive Officer Kartow sweated in his own formal dress uniform, pressed in too close to the Admiral in the narrow corridor. Kartow had prayed for the destroyer's captain to volunteer for the reception party, but the captain had insisted Kartow take his place. The captain was vitally needed on the bridge. The bridge of a ship hanging dead in space with reactors shut down and nothing for the captain to do. Kartow had done as ordered. The discomfort of the awkward silence finally got to Kartow, and he had to say something.
Admiral, you have met the Giraptha before. What are they like?
I have met them, Cacrondo answered,
grateful someone wished to speak with him, even though he knew the conversation was forced. What to say about the Giraptha? That most species thought of them as insects, even though the Giraptha had long ago lost their exoskeletons and now had a greenish, leathery outer skin? 4 legs, 2 arms, and antennas the Giraptha sometimes used as an extra set of fingers? No. Kartow would know all that from the clan database.
The Giraptha appear deceptively unprofessional. They joke and attempt to distract you. They wish you to think of them as not serious, even childish. Do not be fooled. They are a deadly enemy with technology far beyond our capability, and even more advanced than the Theranin.
Cacrondo knew that statement was considered treasonous, and it actually felt good that he no longer needed to care. His impending death was, in a way, a sort of freedom.
I will remain focused on my duty, Admiral, Kartow replied, not knowing what else to say.
To his relief, the indicator light above the airlock blinked, then glowed steadily, as the bay was now fully pressurized. The enemy was coming to visit. The airlock door slid open, and Kartow's nose detected a whiff of something sweet. 3 Giraptha came through the door. Each walked on 4 legs, supporting a horizontal body segment, with their upper body vertical, though their heads barely came up to Cacrondo's chest. They wore white and black clothing and black boots, and each of the 3 wore a different colored band on their left arms. The first one, with a red armband, loudly slurped from a squeeze bottle, and as it drank, it became obvious the bottle was the source of the sweet scent.
You brought beverages with you?
Even Cacrondo was surprised by that. 2 of the Giraptha appeared unsteady on their 4 feet, as if they had been imbibing intoxicating substances during the flight from the star carrier.
Of course,
Blue Armband said as it let out a loud belch, suddenly filling the air in the corridor with the scent of fermented something.
This is an inspection party, right?
Ugh! The giraptor with the yellow armband sputtered while drinking from a squeeze globe it carried in one hand.
This is the worst party ever. Look at all these gloomy faces. Let's get some music on.
It waved the squeeze globe under Kartow's nose.
Here, drink some Bergoja. It will put you in a better mood, it laughed.
Kartow recoiled from the stinky-smelling fluid, pressing his back against the bulkhead.
You are Admiral Kakrondo?
The red-banded giraptor gestured angrily at Kakrondo, going as far as to poke the Kristang senior commander in the chest with an antenna.
You cost me a lot of money, you tuta.
Kakrondo stood his ground, knowing he was being baited, and suspecting the giraptor of being slightly drunk. Or more than slightly.
You put that incompetent fool Gurkhaw in command of your pursuit force, Redband complained as it tapped Kakrondo with its antenna. If that idiot had survived 2 more days, just 2 days, I would have won the pool. He didn't need to capture or destroy Commodore Fallant's ships. All he needed to do was survive for 2 short days. But no, he just couldn't do it, and he cost me a ton of money.
You wagered on the outcome of the battle? Kartow asked, incredulous.
Of course,
Blue Band answered, as if it were the dumbest sort of question.
We always do. How could we pass up juicy action like that? Don't worry about Sakesy,
he gestured with an antenna toward the red-banded giraptha.
He bet on Gurkhaw to survive longer. On our ship everyone knows,
Blue Band spoke in unison with Yellow Band.
Always bet against Sakesy.
That threw Blue and Yellow into uproarious laughter.
Oh, you two are so funny.
Sakesy looked at the deck while furiously sucking on his squeeze bulb, and he let out another loud, odoriferous belch.
Did anyone wager for Captain Gurkhaw to succeed? Kartow asked innocently, sparking the giraptha into convulsive laughter.
The aliens were laughing so hard they couldn't catch their breath, and they were pounding their rear feet on the deck.
Oh, that is a good one. Bet on Gurkhaw? I would not have bet on Gurkhaw to succeed against a group of Ruhar cadets. Against Commodore Ferlant?
The giraptha snickered.
Ha! Ferlant is a skilled and inventive commander. We have been watching his career closely and with much optimism. No, he laughed again. Not even Sakesy would be dumb enough to bet on...
Another round of convulsive laughter.
Gurkhaw to defeat Ferlant.
When the three giraptha caught their breath enough to speak, Kakrondo addressed Blue Band, who appeared to be the leader. At least Blue Band was least unsteady on his feet.
Do you have a wager on how long I will live once we return to the clan?
The Admiral asked, almost with detached disinterest.
Oh, certainly, two of the giraptha slapped antennas. Not long, Blue Band laughed.
If you want a piece of the action, you can get in,
he broke up laughing. Sakesy finished the thought.
But you won't be around to collect.
The actual inspection was shockingly casual, with the giraptha poking randomly around the ship, missing vital areas and wasting time in places like the corridors near the officers' cabins. By the time the inspection was over, Sakesy was swaying so badly on his feet that Blue Band had to support him back to the airlock.
This has been a terrible party, Sakesy complained with a hiccup. Not even any snacks. We...
His thought was interrupted by another belch.
Oh, let's get out of here.
The giraptha were as glad to get off the Kristang destroyer as their hosts were glad to see them go.
That was a pointless exercise, Admiral, Kartow observed with disgust. They didn't inspect anything.
A physical inspection may not have been their purpose, Kakrondo mused. They could have scanned our ship without coming aboard.
Then why bother coming aboard?
I don't know, Kartow. Perhaps they simply wish to gloat over a defeated enemy,
Gekrondo said, misery finally showing on his voice.
I will change out of this uniform.